CityManagerNews.com is your source for news and information related to the profession of city and county management. If you want to know about all the executive transitions that are happening across the country, you want to know about all the jobs that are coming available in the near future, you need to tune in to CityManagerNews.com and check it out on a daily basis. CityManagerNews.com, the number one source for news and information for public sector executives. This episode of the City Manager Unfiltered podcast features an interview with CJ Grisham. He's an attorney who was threatened with arrest and kicked out of a council meeting in Aransas Pass, Texas, because he used various expletives and profane language. We are going to talk about the First Amendment and public comment period during this episode because this is becoming a major topic throughout the country, also in the context of Zoom bombings and racial epithets and so forth and so on. I want to warn you that around the 16-minute mark or so, you're going to hear some extremely profane language as I play a clip from the city council meeting in which CJ Grisham used these expletives. So this episode is not for children, and you're going to want to use discretion in the workplace while listening to this episode. Now, before we jump into this episode with CJ Grisham, I want to remind you all that on May 1st, Micah Gaudet and I are going to make a special announcement about a project we are working on. We are going to share that in a podcast episode being released on May 1st with the regularly scheduled episodes that I do. So please stay tuned for that. I think a lot of you are really going to enjoy that announcement. All right. I'm Joe Turner, and this is the City Manager Unfiltered podcast, a podcast for city managers and other public sector executives. It is the most influential local government podcast in America, and I have a pretty controversial guest with me on the horn today, CJ Grisham. CJ Grisham is an attorney in Texas. First came across him through some stories about him dropping some curse words at a city council meeting, and he's creating kind of ruckus along with his client, who we're going to get into and talk about in a bit more. But we're going to have a conversation about public comment periods at city council meetings, what you can and can't say, what maybe what you should and shouldn't say. And we're going to talk about some of the decorum and issues that are going on in the civil discourse, because as all you guys know, public comment periods around the country have gotten very controversial, gotten very heated. We've had Zoom bombings where people are dropping racial epithets and cursing, a lot of unsavory things that are happening. So cities all across the country are re-examining their public comment periods. They're ending the Zoom public comments. Sometimes they're going out and censoring the comments or censoring the language after the meetings have been conducted and when they upload them and so forth and so on. And CJ Grisham's with us. He has some thoughts on the matter. And CJ, before we get into what the Aransas Pass situation is, where you came on my radar, why don't you give us a little backstory about your origin story so there's some context about what you're about, what you believe, and how we got to this point.
Sure, Joseph. First of all, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. Yeah, so I come from a military background. My dad was in the Navy. His dad before him was in the Army Air Corps. We've got all the way back to the Texas Revolution, a history of military service. And at one point, I decided to join the Army. I started out as a Spanish linguist working in South America. And then after the USS Cole bombing in 2000, switched over to counterintelligence and decided that I was going to try to fight terrorism instead of essentially what was becoming the drug war. And did that for 21 years. I fought in Iraq, fought in Afghanistan, and retired in 2015, and decided, and just before I retired, I was out hiking with my son and ended up getting arrested because I live out in the country, and everywhere we go, I carry a rifle with me. It's either in the tractor, the truck, on my foot, or on foot while I'm walking, because we do have, you know, wild animals, hogs, and other stuff out here. And I was helping my son do a Boy Scout hike to get his hiking merit badge so he can get his Eagle Scout. And about halfway through our hike, five miles into our 10-mile hike, again, out in the country, I hear a voice behind me. I turn around. There's a police officer. He doesn't have his lights on or anything. He's just like, hold on a minute. And so I turn around. I stop. And he's like, what are you doing? I said, we're hiking. And then he walks up to me and he grabs my rifle. And he says, is there some reason why you've got this? And it literally confused me, the question, because And my answer was because I can,
because I'm an American and I'm a Texan and I have the right to carry. Yeah,
exactly. And he's like, oh, okay. And then he tries to disarm me. Well, as any soldier knows, if someone grabs your gun, it's just instinctual that you try to preserve someone taking your firearm from you. And I instantly, for about half a second, stuck my hand on the barrel and the buttstock of the rifle to prevent, you know, the officer from taking it. And then instantly realized what I was doing. And I put my hands up, Well, that resulted in me getting a gun stuck to my head and throwing onto the hood of a car in front of my son. And that turned me into a gun rights activist. That day, my goal was just to go on a hike. And there was no ulterior motives whatsoever other than to go on a 10-mile hike with my son out in the country.
So you ain't walking around with an AR-15 strapped to your back, walking into a Costco somewhere. Not trying to be a provocateur. You're just minding your own business out in the countryside.
Right. On that day, that's exactly what I was doing. And I wasn't even a gun rights activist at that point. I was an advocate. I believed in the Second Amendment. I grew up with guns. But if I wanted to really make a point, I could have just as legally walked around downtown with my AR-15.
You can. Yeah.
And I carry an AR-15 because when I started buying guns, in my mind, I thought, why am I going to buy a gun I'm not familiar with? I've spent my entire adult life in the military with the M4, which is essentially the military version of the AR-15. And I know how to take that thing apart and clean it in my sleep. So those are the guns I have. Those are my rifles, is the AR-15, because I'm comfortable with it for hunting, shooting, target practice, whatever. That's what I use as an AR-15.
So CJ, when I first learned about you, obviously I learned about you through the Aransas Pass whole situation, right? That's what was my only context. And I did a little bit of research and I came across that video on YouTube, has millions of views. Like you said, several years ago, probably about 8 years ago or so now, or whatever it is.
Right.
And that was sort of what triggered you to sort of get on this path that you're on now as being an attorney and sort of going to bat for, I guess, I don't know if you're focusing on gun rights or all I know is a First Amendment city council comment type thing. So what, walk us through that whole progression.
Yeah. So that incident turned me into a gun rights activist at that point. And I started an organization called Open Carry Texas, because Texas was one of only six states at the time that did not allow the open carry of handguns. And I wanted to change this culture in law enforcement that just because they can see that you have a gun, that somehow you're a threat and they need to treat you like some kind of murderer or something. The way I was treated, you know, I had a gun stuck to my head in front of my son and I wasn't breaking any laws. So I became a gun rights activist, and no, the attorney thing didn't come anywhere into play at that point.
Okay.
And again, this was 2013. So it was 11 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Actually, this month, 11 years ago, this month, March 16th, 2013. So I started Open Carry Texas, and our goal was, that's when I started becoming a little more in your face about things. And if you remember 2013 to about 2015, there were national stories about all these Texans walking around into Target and into Starbucks and into all these different places with their AR-15s.
Yeah.
That's what we were doing. And we were trying to make a point. And that point was, I can legally walk around with this AR-15, this AK-47, this shotgun, whatever. But if you can see my handgun, I'm a criminal.
Right.
And just to draw awareness to the absurdity of that. And yeah, we used ways to get attention, and it worked. We got the very first legislative session that we were in established in 2015, because our legislature meets every 2 years. We got open carry passed, and we were the 45th state to allow open carry of handguns. I mean, this is Texas. Everyone thinks we're this gun happy the state, and we're so far behind at the time.
Interesting. So how does what happens then? How do we get from there to where you're at now?
I got arrested two more times for lawful open carry. And again, all these charges kept getting dismissed. But it doesn't change the fact that you spend between 10 and 15 hours in jail, then you got to spend hundreds or thousands of dollars to bond out.
Right.
And in 2018, I got arrested in Olmos Park, which is just a subdivision kind of, or a little small enclave in San Antonio. And it wasn't just any arrest. We were there to protest the way that if you're open carrying, the cops down there would draw down on you at gunpoint and order you like a dog onto the ground. And so I had called the police chief and said, hey, I'm coming down there and we're going to exercise our rights, because we're going to teach you that open carry is legal in Texas. And he's like, oh, I know open carry is legal. I get down there, and sure enough, the cops come down the road. They're on both sides of us. They've got their guns drawn, their AR-15, their pistols drawn at us, ordering us on the ground at gunpoint. Now, I had taken with me combat veterans because I knew that we were likely going to have guns drawn on us. And I wanted to make sure that the people that were protesting with
me were trained,
weren't going to overreact. They were trained and not freak out because someone's pointing guns at them. So I took a bunch of combat vets with me. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. We refused to get on the ground. I kept demanding the police chief to show up. Well, the police chief shows up and he makes it worse. He continues to order us on the ground. I say no. Then he orders a cop, I think, to arrest me. This cop's trying to arrest me. I've got my hands in the air. I'm backing up away from him, telling him to leave me alone. I haven't broken any laws. And while I'm doing that, the chief literally tases me in the back with his taser from about 5 feet away.
Wow.
I immediately stiffen and fall like a plank into the concrete and cracked my head open and ended up in the hospital with a concussion. And I don't even remember much of what happened that day, but it was all on film, thankfully. And they charged me with felony assault on a peace officer and among other crimes.
Okay.
Now we got all that. Thankfully, because I had set everything up, I had cameras everywhere. Thankfully, I was able to get all those charges dropped because, you know, when you're sitting there in front of a magistrate and she says, oh, okay, you got a $15,000 bond for felony assault on a peace officer. And I'm like, Your Honor, what did I do? Fall on his foot when he tased me? How did I assault him?
Right.
That's really when I realized, you know what? I've had enough of this. I'm tired of fighting these guys in the streets. I'm going to law school. And 2019, a year later, took the LSAT. Passed that, or at least got a good enough score to get into colleges of my choice, and then chose a law school out in the mountains of Virginia so I could kind of get away and learn law.
So how old are you at this point, CJ? Because I'm looking at you and you don't look like you're 25. You got some gray hair on there.
Well, I just turned 50, so I was 47 years old.
Okay.
Or 46 years old when I went to law school. And yeah, I wasn't the oldest guy in my class, but the two individuals that were older than me didn't make it through the entire, it is difficult, especially when you're old and you've got to retrain your mind back into this, you know, learning mode.
Yeah. It's an adjustment. I went back to get my master's when I was in my early 30s after being out of school for about a decade. And it was a little bit of an adjustment. Then I can only imagine being at, you know, 47 years of age, which is what I'm going to be in a couple months. So,
yeah.
But so you go to law school, you get your law degree. And at this point in time, you're thinking primarily, again, a Second Amendment gun rights type work you're going to do, I'm assuming.
Well, first and second, because keep in mind when you're...
Well, you can't have the first without the second, brother.
Exactly. And the thing is, when you're exercising, you know, when you're a Second Amendment activist, you need to exercise your First Amendment rights to get your message across. And so everything that we did, all of our protests, of course, we've got this symbolic rifle on our chest that is our message. That's our message. How is it that I can carry this but not a pistol? And so it was expressive speech just to have the guns there. And all of our rallies, we had hundreds of guns at these rallies because we were trying to show people it's not the gun that's the problem. Otherwise, every time we had a rally, you'd have all kinds of shootings and stuff. So First and Second Amendment has always been very important to me. And I knew that's exactly what I was going to focus on when I became an attorney. And that's what I do focus on now. And it seems like I'd say about 50% of my caseload is First Amendment and the other 50% are self-defense cases.
Got you. Okay. So we've got to speed now and you're got this, you know, dual sort of focus, right? First and Second Amendment type stuff approach to your law practice and whatnot. What I'm going to do here now is I'm going to play a short clip. It's about 3 minutes long because it's a public comment period of CJ going up to the Aransas Pass City Council and making his case. Now, the context here is that his client, Jason Falwell, has just spoken right before him for a few minutes, and he was booted out under threat of arrest because he was cursing at the police chief and the mayor and so forth and so on, and being very disruptive from an objective standpoint. Maybe CJ might disagree on that. We'll come back to that. And so Jason Falwell gets booted because he has a grievance before the city council, and we'll unpack that in a second. And then CJ, you get up there and you start speaking and you say this.
Mr. Mayor, City Council, my name is C.J. Grisham. I'm a civil rights attorney here in Texas, and what I just witnessed was a violation of Mr. Falwell's rights. Let me read something to you. Arresting someone in retaliation for the exercise of free speech rights is sufficient to chill speech as an understatement. This is Beck v. City of Upland. Arguing, even if done loudly with a profane or offensive language, will not in and of itself constitute disorderly conduct. That's Payne v. Pauley. swear words do not provide probable cause for an arrest for disorderly conduct because the words, as a matter of law, are not fighting words. Johnson v. Campbell. I could go on, Mr. Mayor. Your rules of decorum are unconstitutional, and they're setting the city up, you individually, for liability. Now, you will be seeing a letter from me, a demand letter, for violating my client's rights just now, because he has the right to say fuck, shit, damn, bitch, cunt, whatever. Oh. He has the right to say all of those words, because it is a First Amendment right. You can't do anything about it. Let me tell you something. The law has long established that arresting an individual for publicly displaying vulgarities violates the First Amendment. That's the Cohen case, 1969. Indeed, the Supreme Court recently held that a public school violated the free speech rights of a cheerleader by suspending her when she said things like, fuck school, fuck softball, fuck cheer, fuck everything. Then there was another, that's Mahoney Area School District v. BL. There's also Eaches v. Steelman saying that a police officer was not entitled to qualified immunity for arresting a plaintiff who said, fuck you. Did you hear that?
Here we go.
No qualified immunity. So I can say fuck throughout my entire 3 minutes. I can say fuck again, and I can say fuck again, and there's nothing you can do about it because it's called expressive speech. We are allowed to express ourselves. We are allowed to fucking talk about what we think about you. If I think you, Mr. Mayor, are a tyrant, okay. I can say that. If I think the city manager is a piece of shit, I can say that. It's protected. This is the case law. I don't give a shit what you think. The law is right. You escort me out, I'll sue you as well, Mr. Mayor.
Do whatever you want.
This is the law right here. And if these chiefs come out here and pull me out of this meeting, you had better read this, chief, because he's telling you to break the law.
Mayor, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
Mayor, you can take him out.
Now, where'd that coward Kerry Scruggs go?
You go out.
Where'd the coward Kerry Scruggs go?
Take him out.
Is my 3 minutes up?
You're gone.
No. Is my what am I gone for? No. What am I gone for? No, no. He pulls the court violate the law.
You're
gonna
go to jail for disorderly.
Oh, you're gonna arrest me? Oh, you're gonna arrest me? Okay, so under the threat of arrest, you just violate.
All right. Oh, shit, cunt motherfucker.
So, CJ, you come out of the you get threatened with arrest. You get escorted out of the building. I'm gonna say it. I mean, I'm a rabble rouser myself. I'm a provocateur. I've been on that side of the coin as far as being disruptive at city council meetings. I used to be an activist, so I can see all sides of the equation. I've never dropped a C-bomb or the N-word at a city council meeting, to be fair. Walk us through this whole thing, because on one hand, I am sympathetic to the idea of First Amendment and you should have these rights to say what you want to say, but I think you will admit and be honest, like, hey, that's a pretty disruptive and impolite way to carry yourself at a public meeting. Is that fair to say?
I will definitely say it's impolite. I won't agree that it's disruptive because those are my 3 minutes. When you get to public comments, it's kind of hard to disrupt yourself. But I will agree that it is definitely impolite, and I will even say it's probably uncivil. But there's a whole backstory to this. This was not just me showing up and all of a sudden dropping the F-bomb and the C-bomb and all these other words that I was saying. This city council had a history of harassing and retaliating against my client. I was actually paid to go down there to witness it for myself and to really just try to put them on notice as to what Mr. Followell's rights were to avoid civil litigation.
Okay, and why don't we unpack this a little bit for the audience, okay, CJ? Because you just coincidentally, you just a few days ago filed a lawsuit on behalf of your client, and you sort of go through the backstory in that. And obviously, the listeners haven't had a chance to read that case. So, why don't you give us a brief little context as far as what precipitated or what led up to the situation where your client Jason Followell and then you are going to the public comment period and then eventually getting booted out?
Yeah, and this all started with the city harassing my client because he goes to city council meetings. He's very engaged. He's always been very respectful, but holding city council accountable. And rather than do the right thing, what they started doing, the chief of police, was retaliating against his business. They would do these constant inspections, even though they're only supposed to be doing annual inspections, and would find all these little nitpicky things. And if the the fire chief had his own business just down the road that had, for example, the insulation that was in the roof, the exact same insulation that the fire chief has, but yet my client was getting ticketed for it. And they would find like pallets that were stacked up against the wall, and they were claiming that that was rubbish when that's not the definition of rubbish. And they were using that to get warrants to go in and search his business. That's how I came to find out about him, which was around August or September of last year. He hired me to help him with all of these retaliatory code violations. And we successfully got those dismissed. But the problem was the city wasn't happy about the fact that he was, quote, getting away with it. And they kept ratcheting down, and he would come to city council and he'd be like, okay, well, here's what you're doing now. And then city council would ignore him. The chief of police would retaliate again. And then he'd get more angry. And then he'd go to city council more angry about the fact that the city manager's not doing his job. The city mayor's not doing his job. They keep targeting my client. And so you've got this constant escalation where my client's trying to hold government accountable. So they retaliated against him with criminal measures. Well, then he goes and complains about these fake criminal measures. So they just start retaliating against him, and he gets more angry. And we get to the point where at one point he calls the city manager a POS, a piece of excrement. And
in the meeting.
In the meeting. Yeah, during his 3 minutes of time, because he's looking straight at the city manager and he's going, your chief and the courts have proven that your chief raided my business without a warrant. Are you going to do something about this? And the city manager just stood there looking at him, kind of smirking. And that's when he called him a POS. Well, then, of course, they come up with these rules of decorum and, oh, you can't criticize us and you can't use profanity and all that. And that's when I get involved again on the civil side. And he asked me to come down because they had threatened him with arrest. Well, I sent them a notice. I said, look, you can't do that. He has a right to speak his mind, to speak his opinion. You don't have to like it, but he has a right to say whatever he wants during his 3 minutes, you know, as long as it's not threatening, as long as it's not illegal in any way. And again, I'm not making any comment on to whether or not that's what I recommend he does, but it's protected speech. And the whole purpose of the First Amendment is to protect speech that people disagree with. So I don't.
We'll come back to that in a little bit, yeah. CJ, because that's something I want to unpack a little bit more. But I want to kind of put a whole fine point on this. And to be fair, obviously this is City Manager Unfiltered. I generally lean towards being pro city manager. I have not reached out to the city manager and got his side of the story or anything like that. Just for full disclosure to the audience. And when you talk about this current situation, a minute ago you alluded to the fact that I guess Falwell went to court and the court found in his favor. Can you unpack that for a second, because I wasn't aware of that little fact.
Yeah, so he got a bunch of code violations. He went to the municipal court to fight these code violations on his own. He won the case. The judge threw it out because all of these code violations were, these alleged code violations were discovered on a warrantless search.
Okay.
And so that was tossed out. But instead of just moving on, what the city did instead was appeal to the county. And so they threw the case into the county courts, and that's where he hired me. And then I went and I defended him, did these motions to dismiss because of the warrantless search. We won again against the chief and the city. And then that's where all of this now that where you heard what I had said kind of starts coming into play.
Okay. And I don't want to spend obviously the entire podcast talking about the backstory to what this, so I want to put a fine point on this, CJ, is my understanding based off what I read in your lawsuit is that the fire chief and what you alluded to earlier basically had similar violations that were not being prosecuted under the same code by the city. And also, is it correct that the mayor's brother or something was involved with doing the inspections or something?
Yeah, the mayor's brother was doing inspections. The fire chief was declaring his business as exempt, even though statutorily my client's business was exempt. And the city, one of the city council women, she had also sent him a cease and desist because he had uncovered, my client had uncovered that she had signed a death certificate that she wasn't supposed to sign. That was a lie. So there's all kinds of these little things.
Got you. Okay. Yeah. And obviously, again, for the sake of the audience, I have not reached out to the city to get their perspective on this and whatever. But and so I don't want to get too far in the weeds on that. But let's just move forward now to the actual meeting. So Falwell, after all this backstory now, Falwell goes to this meeting. You're there. This is an orchestra. And when I say orchestrated, is you guys have basically made it very clear you're going to there to make a point. And it looks like the point that you wanted to make was that you can kind of say whatever you want in a council meeting. And they sort of, if your interpretation of the law and everything is correct, it seemed like they just walked right into the trap that you guys set, very, very transparent trap that you set for them. Am I correct on that?
Yeah. And that's a good way to describe it. What I was doing was the building blocks of a civil suit. And the way I try to do things is I try to avoid lawsuits because they're expensive, they're time consuming. And so my goal of being there was to document and record. And then when I got up, I was going to educate them on the case law, which is exactly what I did. And I intentionally chose cases that were specific to the words that my client has used over the past few months in city council, where he's been threatened with arrest. And those include the F word, the MF word, the C word, you know, the female dog word, all that stuff. And every case that I brought up was specific to a word he had used in the past and been threatened with. You can't say that. The idea, the point was to read the case law and put them on notice. Stop what you're doing. You don't have to like it, but you can't violate my client's rights. And I am not going to stand by and let you violate my client's rights. So here's the case law. And at the very end, I said, so if I want to say, and I quoted all the different words that were in these cases that I'd written down for them on a sheet of paper, then I can do that. If Mr. Falwell wants to say that, he can do that. And there's nothing you can do about it. Well, instead of just listening and ignoring us like too many city councils do, you know, that's what they really need to learn how to do, is when you've got an angry person up there that might be a little unhinged, you think he's unhinged, just ignore him. Let him have his 3 minutes and then go sit down, and you just don't react to it, because when you react to it, they're going to react back.
You know, that's a funniest thing you say that, because what I've always advised my governing body when we have these conversations about public comment, and I've worked in small town communities, so it's a little bit, it's an interesting dichotomy, because small town councils in their essence is they want to be relatable. They want to, you know, they know these folks. It's very much more of a connected sort of sense of community. And so there's a natural desire to want to be responsive and assist and be engaged in a public comment period. But very, very rarely does anything positive happen when that occurs, you know? And my position is just, you know, let them speak, have their 3 minutes, don't say anything, thank them for their day, let them be on their way, and de-escalate the situation. Because whenever you engage and go into a back and forth, it's going to escalate the situation and give that person more fuel for the fire, essentially.
Right. And I like the way that my city council does it. When people get up there like myself and we complain about something that's going on, what they always do is later they will send me an email saying, this is how we understand your complaint. You know, we understand that you're worried about this. Here's what we're doing, or here's what we have done to address your concern. And therefore you're not getting into this tit for tat in the middle of a city council meeting. You're addressing it after the fact with the people who are interested in that particular aspect, you know, whether it's a parks issue or a streets issue or a rights issue. And that's the right way to do it. But the wrong way to do it is just to tell people, I am not going to put up with this. You are not going to disrespect us. Sorry, but it's the other way around. And
I can tell you, I mean, I don't know if we want to get into your political bent or anything here, CJ. I assume you're right of center or something like that in the political spectrum, but I'm right of center. And I know from my personality, the last thing I want when I was an activist was to have somebody on the dais from on high trying to lecture me as far as what I can and can't do. That really just baits me into being really pissed off. But I'm now on the other side. So I have this really weird kind of contradictory sort of perspective on things as being on the administrative side, CJ, because, you know, we've seen the profession and local government become much more volatile, much more divisive, much more fractured. It's just becoming a very caustic environment that honestly, I think you and I can both agree that is not really going into a good place, right? I think the civil discourse in this country is really kind of devolving. And I think it would be nice to get into a more civil construct. And I guess that's where I have this sort of interesting conflict when I have this discussion with you, because on one hand, as an activist and a purist, as far as First Amendment and so forth, I'm like, yeah, I'm sympathetic to that. And you should be able to say what you want to say and so forth and so on. But we're talking about local government and trying to do the people's business and, you know, city business and things like that. And these meetings can be very disruptive when people are allowed to talk the way they are and the way Jason was and the way you have been. So I kind of want to unpack this for a little bit here. You know, we are talking about the state of Texas. This is where you are practicing law. Okay. And you read off some case law. Is everything that you're talking about under the scope of the federal government, First Amendment, Bill of Rights permission? And do we have any state specific statutes or anything else that we need to talk about? Because when I first started posting about your situation, I asked city managers from across the country to give me some questions or feedback because I said, hey, I want to have this guy on the podcast and interview him, right? And some folks were saying, well, you know, some states don't even require city councils to have a public comment period. Some don't require them to have, maybe they're required to have a comment period for an itemized agenda item, but not for just a general public comment period. And I was wondering, is there anything state specific or, I know you're not licensed to practice law in all 50 states, and maybe it's an unfair question, but are we talking about purely from a First Amendment federal perspective? And do you have any thoughts on differences between Texas and other states? And maybe there's some nuances that you can unpack for the audience and say, yeah, you know, we're talking about Texas only. I can't speak to these other states.
I can actually speak to any of it. So the way that federal law works and the First Amendment works, because Texas, there is no law that forces city councils or county commissioners, courts, or school boards or anything to have a public comment period. What they are required to do is if there's an open meeting agenda, that the people are allowed and must be given time to comment on agenda items. Some city councils, that's all they allow. Any government entity, some open meetings, government entities, that's all they allow. Some they allow a separate time for citizen comments that are off agenda, so they can talk about anything they want to. That's what Aransas Pass had. Now, if a city government, and this applies federally, if a city government has a comment period in which it is unrestricted as to what citizens can talk about, that particular government entity is forbidden under the First Amendment from discriminating against speakers based on the content of their speech. So obviously, if it's illegal type stuff like making threats or, for example, what's the word? Not profanity, but obscenity. So obscenity is not protected. Fighting.
So what's the difference between obscenity and profanity then?
So the difference between obscenity is the use of words that cause people to engage in this prurient. It's essentially sexual in nature.
Okay.
That it goes towards the sexual nature. So for example, you think about the F word, if you're just using it as kind of an adverb or an adjective or something, that's perfectly fine. But if you are telling the city council woman, hey, I'm going to bend you over and, you know, start going that way.
Right.
That's where it goes into obscenity.
Now let me ask you this, and I'm sorry to segue.
Prurient sexual interests.
Well, let me go off on a little tangent then, and I'm sorry to do this, but you know the school boards have been very volatile lately with members of the public, parents going to council meet or the school board meetings to talk about some of the sexual nature of the books and libraries and whatnot. And you've seen little kids even read the content of these books. Is that considered obscenity then, or is that walk into a fine line, or how walk us through that aspect of it?
Yeah, I think that's really where the argument is. Is this is not about education. It is about obscenity. You're talking about children having sexual intercourse and different types of sexual intercourse, and that is engaging the prurient sexual interests of the listener.
But is a member of the public going to a school board meeting and reading graphic passages in a book, is that considered education or obscenity because they're highlighting what is in these books, I guess is what I'm kind of...
Okay, so that's
about a gray area. Okay.
Yeah, so that's neither, because what they're doing is they're quoting what's out there. When you're, for example, I was quoting case law. So even if it would have been wrong to say those things, what I'm doing is I'm saying, this is what these parents are doing. They're saying, okay, you're saying it's okay to have in the schools. Then why is it not okay for me to speak about here in the city council or in the county courts or in the school boards? So that's a little bit different. There is kind of a gray area. Now, if they just go in there and talk about kids, you know, having sex or whatever, that's different. But in this particular case, what they are specifically talking about is the fact that these books are obscenity and they are dealing with sexual interests and sexual aspects or subjects that kids are being subjected to.
Okay. So let's go back to, I want to come back to that point you just made in a little bit later on, but let's go back to Aransas Pass and public comment periods in Texas. Okay. So CJ, one of the city managers who contacted me about this interview and they had a question, their point was something along the lines of this. One, if a city is not required to give a public comment period and they choose to do so, don't they have the ability to put rules on that since they're basically going that route? Your argument is essentially that no, in Texas, if you decide to have a public comment period, you can't limit it in any way. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying this is national. If a city is having a public comment period, they can have reasonable rules. So under the First Amendment, a government body may, if they're not required to have public comments, create reasonable rules within the limits of the First Amendment that govern that. And generally what the courts have found is, for example, in Texas, you know, reasonable rules include time limits, or, you know, they might also, instead of having comments during each agenda item at the beginning of the meeting, you sign up to speak on the agenda items you want to speak on, and they give you so many minutes to speak on all those agenda items. So they're those kinds of rules are fine. What they cannot do, and this is 50 statewide, this is entire country, if you have an open public comments period, the rules cannot be designed to restrict the type of speech based on the content of that speech. That's where most city councils and government bodies falter. For example, in Aransas Pass, they have two rules that violate the First Amendment. One is you're not really allowed to criticize the city council, and two, you're not allowed to use profanity. Both of those are protected. The Supreme Court has found both of those to be protected, and that's where the rules run afoul. Now, you can say that you must address the chair, which is usually the mayor, that you can't address anybody else. You know, the simple Robert's Rules of Order type things. But when it comes to the content of that speech, that's where the limitations apply under the Constitution.
So this whole idea of being able to have rules of decorum per se at a city council meeting, public comment period, is that's just bunk. That's not true. You can't have any sort of rules on that regard.
Well, it just depends. And I can't really go. There are rules of decorum that can be had. They just can't be based on the content of speech. You can't say you cannot criticize us. You can't.
Can't you have a rule that says you can't curse then? I mean, why can't you have that? No,
because profanity is protected speech. It's descriptive speech, and that's basically telling people how to speak. And so, the First Amendment specifically protects that.
So this leads into a question that another city manager sent me. His name is John. The question from John, a city manager in Kansas, is, would the type of conduct or language CJ communicated in the council meeting be allowed in a Texas court of law? The attorney said that none of the profanity rose to the level of fighting words. Does CJ believe that if he walked into a Texas court and started throwing the language around in the context of denigrating someone in the courtroom, that he should not get thrown out because of that? Because, I mean, when you go into a courtroom and you talk to a judge, you can't just start cursing at the judge. You can be held in contempt and so forth and so on. So what separates, for example, a public comment period in a city council meeting to, say, a courtroom?
That's a great question. I think this is where many city managers don't understand how the First Amendment works. City council meetings are what's called traditional public forums, whereas a court is a non-traditional public forum. So it's free speech does not exist in the courtroom. The Supreme Court has ruled that there is no right to free speech inside a courtroom while a case is being had, whereas they have ruled that in the public square, at open meetings, things of that nature, that is a traditional public forum where the people have had a traditional right to speak and address grievances. When you go before a trial court, you're not addressing grievances. You've got a case there. It's a criminal case or it's a civil case, and there is a matter that's being discussed before the court. You cannot go into a court and start protesting like you can go into a city council or onto the public square and protest.
Okay. So here's the second question that the same city manager sent me, CJ. He goes, does he believe that if he walked into a bar in Texas and started throwing that language around in the context of denigrating someone at the bar, that he wouldn't get thrown out before he got his ass handed to him?
So there's separate issues there as well. A bar is private property. It's not a traditional public forum.
Right.
And when we talk about the First Amendment, there are traditional public forums, limited public forums, and then what's called non-traditional public forums. a bar is not a place that people go to protest unless that bar holds itself out to be a protest. You know, there are some bars or some restaurants that, you know, they have, for example, Pride Nights. Well, at that point, they're turning it at that point into a public forum if the public is invited to push a particular agenda. When you're in a bar, if you start using the kinds of words and, you know, there's the fighting words is an exception under the First Amendment. Fighting words are not protected. Things like if the theater is not on fire, you know, yelling fire in a crowded theater when there is no fire, that's not protected, where you create a panic. And if you incite people to violence, that is not protected. But the courts have also found that public officials should know and expect that they're going to be criticized, and they're held to a higher standard, just like police are held to an even higher standard when people are using profanity against them as opposed to the general public. But no, I expect if I go into a bar and I get in someone's face and I call them a POS or I start calling them the C word or whatever, by all means, I expect someone to lay me flat, or at least try to lay me flat on the ground.
And, you know, this is an interesting kind of evolution in our country right now, the way things are going with language and politics. And I don't want to get into politics per se, but I think it's pertinent to this discussion, CJ. You know, we talk about fighting words. You know, there used to be a time in this country where it seemed to be that very few things would be considered a fighting word, that, you know, free speech, you got to control your emotions. You can't hit someone just because you don't like what they say. And we've seen a ratcheting up of rhetoric in this country when it comes to words equaling violence, as some of the more woke leftist sort of kind of social justice sort of think as it creeps into public discourse. We've seen things like silence equaling violence, which is to me is kind of an interesting contradictory deal. Now you can't even say the N-word, right? If you say the N-word, no matter what the context, if you're quoting somebody, if you are quoting a song lyric, which absolutely boggles my mind that you have young kids who are, you know, in high school or college who quote a song lyric and they're basically being canceled left and right. You can't even say certain words now, because if you say it, it's almost like it's opened up a legitimate response to be physically attacked by another person. I mean, literally. So when you say something like the N-word or whatnot, is that considered a fighting word if you just utter it? Or is this something that's evolving in law right now? And I realize we're kind of going off onto a little bit of a tangent, but obviously it begs the question that if you can go to a council meeting and say the C-word or say anything else that you said in that clip, can you say the N-word and get away with it?
I think generally that's a very good question, because it all depends on context, and the law will determine that context based on the facts and the totality of the circumstances. You know, if you're just quoting a song, you know, and say, "Hey man, I heard this song by YT, my N-word," that in no way in the legal world is a judge going to say, "Yeah, that's a fighting word." Now, if you walk up into someone's face and you go, "Hey N-word, you know, who do you think you're talking to?" That would be considered likely a fighting word. I think the problem that we've come to in this country is like what you just said, where people think that words equal violence. And in Texas, at least, the use of force is never justified based on words alone.
And even the N-word? Even if you said, hey, if you call someone...
Unless it's used as in a fighting words context. And that is, you have to have the intent that by saying what you said, you have to know that it's going to incite violence. It's going to incite someone to get violent.
Okay. But if you're in a bar, right? If you and I are in a bar, yeah, and you see two dudes talking to each other, let's just say a hypothetical white dude and a black dude, right? And that white dude says, "What the F are you going to do about it, N-word," or something like that. Yeah. That's pretty much fighting, right? Those are fighting words. Or
that
no?
would be to the person he's addressing it to.
Yes.
But,
yes.
But not to the casual listener on the side.
I'm tracking you. Yeah.
And then it would also be different if, for example, like you and I right now speaking over the phone or over the internet, if I were to say that, it's not a fighting word because I am not causing you to immediately engage in violence against me in response, because you can't.
Yeah, it's physically
impossible for you to punch me right now. So it can't be a fighting word, even if I'm using it in a negative context. I know it sounds like it's one of those things that who knows what it really means, but the courts have really flushed this out. It's kind of like there was a case a long time ago, and they were talking about pornography, and the question was to the court, you know, what is pornography? And the judge said, "I can't really define it, but I'll know it when I see it."
Yeah, it's that classic. Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of the same thing about fighting words. You know, if you get in someone's face, for example, you can go to the police example. You know, if you're yelling at the police across the street, calling them MFers, you know, or calling them names or whatever, those aren't fighting words. But if you go and you approach a cop in a very threatening manner and you get in his face, you go, look, MFer, and you start cursing at him, that even for a police officer could be considered fighting words at that point, because now you're causing him to want to fight you because of the language that you're using.
Well, and you're also physically in their correct within distance of actually hurting that person,
the
right?
I mean, totality of the circumstances is what a court looks at to determine fighting words.
So, okay. So CJ, so here's the deal, right? I'm sure I have a lot of city managers listening to this podcast right now who say, you know what? I agree, you know, with CJ in the grand scheme of things when it comes to the First Amendment, and we got to be, you know, grownups, and we can't just let, you know, words cause us to, you know, respond physically or whatnot, right? But man, God, that guy's kind of a douchebag, though. You know what I'm saying, CJ? I mean, it's like, you know, there is a point where it's like we all work in an environment where we'd like to have some more professional decorum. We'd like to have some civility in the public discourse, right? So what are your thoughts on where this is going and where it's heading? Because I think you agreed, like, that's not really an ideal situation to be in, even if you, you know what I'm saying?
Well, and let me predicate what I'm about to say with this. Everyone should just be civil to each other. And you know, whether you're talking to your elected officials or you're talking to the police, you know, just try to be civil. You know, we can all handle our disagreements without profanity and calling of names and all that kind of stuff. We can
But CJ, I gotta be fair. I gotta call you out. I mean, cause at that meeting you got heated and you weren't necessarily being, okay. All right.
I'll tell you why, because what is more offensive? I think even those city managers that disagree with my speech and my client's speech, everyone out there, take a good hard look at this question. What is more offensive, being called a name or being thrown in a cage and having to spend thousands of dollars to prove your innocence because you used a word? What is more offensive to the American people, your loss of freedom or having to hear a bad word? And so what we've got to realize is my client used a bad word and then was threatened to be thrown in a cage and have his life turned upside down, having to use his hard-earned money to defend himself, hire an attorney, get a bond, and all of that kind of stuff. So it's on one hand, yes, let's be civil. Keep in mind, when I went up there, I was up there because they had threatened to arrest my client because my client used words that they didn't like. And then all I did was quote case law, and then I got threatened with arrest, and I got shut down. Just right. For literally quoting case law. And then that's when I got pissed off and angry, was because now I'm being threatened to get thrown in a cage for doing nothing else than educating the city council on what our rights are. So this escalation goes both ways. You know, I would love to scream and yell at each other. I think that's what we should do, is just scream and yell at each other, because if we keep screaming and yelling at each other, eventually we're going to find some common ground or we're going to start understanding each other. But when you're screaming, when one side's screaming and the other side is threatening to throw you in a cage over your screaming, that's where we have a breakdown in civility. When we're using the weight of government and the threat of criminal activity and ruining someone's life over a word or a series of words.
So we first started, when I first heard about you, obviously, was this case where you got escorted out of the city council chambers. And in that period of time, and in the last week, you filed a lawsuit against the city on behalf of your client. I don't think you've actually filed one as being a victim, even though you were escorted out of the building as well. Is that correct? I think you've only filed on behalf of your client, I guess. Can you walk us through what's... Can you walk us through that, or what's going on with that lawsuit?
Yeah, so this whole thing that predicated this particular interview happened on January 16th of this year. And then on March 1st, I had actually sent the city council an email prior to that, kind of like a cease and desist. Stop, you're violating my client's rights. And then January 16th happened, where I went there and they did it again. Then they did it to me. And then I was like, okay, that's it. They obviously don't care. We're just going to have to file a lawsuit and teach them another way. And so on March 1st, I filed the lawsuit. On March 4th, I went back to the city council. I did sort of a faux apology to the city council, where I mentioned that the police chief is smarter on his worst day than all of us are collectively on our best days. I should listen to him. And I said, you know, the chief, last time I was here and you threatened to arrest me and I was complaining about the fact that you're violating my rights, you said, stop talking and just sue me. And I said, okay, chief, here's your lawsuit. And then I had my assistant present them all with their lawsuits on March 4th. Well, on March 13th, the chief filed charges against me for cursing at, he called it hindering a proceeding by disorderly conduct. The fact of the matter is it's retaliation. It's nothing more than to shut someone up who had just filed a $5 million lawsuit against the city for the violation of his client's rights and daring to stand up there and quote case law just because they didn't like the words that were used. It's impossible to hinder a proceeding when these are my 3 minutes to speak. As the agenda itself said, it was for me to speak on things that were not on the agenda. And that's exactly what I did. And I expressed myself the way I express myself, the way I have a right to express myself. They don't have to like it, but they cannot use the government to retaliate against me and create criminal charges based on lawful activity.
So let's talk about this lawsuit a little bit more. The $5 million lawsuit you filed on behalf of your client, Jason Falwell. The defendants are named as who?
So the defendants are the city of Aransas Pass, the city mayor, the city manager, the city police chief, the city fire chief, and one of the city council women.
Okay. So here's the thing. I'm a little bit confused by that. Okay. Because you filed a lawsuit against only a couple members of the governing body, not the entire governing body. And you also have a lawsuit filed against the city manager, but the city manager doesn't run the meeting and is not involved in escorting you out of the building and so forth. Now, he obviously did speak up in the meeting and sort of like, you know, I don't want to say baited the mayor to make a decision or whatnot, but he basically called you out a little bit. But the city manager doesn't have an ability to escort you out of the building or silence you during public comment, period. So how is he a named defendant in this case?
So in the case, we lay out each and every aspect and an element of what each person did. So for example, the city councilwoman, what she did was send in cease and desist letters to my client, essentially trying to shut him up or threatening him with a lawsuit. And that's against the Texas Citizens Participation Act. With the city mayor and the city manager, they both colluded or conspired to violate rights by getting the police chief to arrest or threaten to arrest myself and my client.
Are you specifically referring to the incident at the council meeting when he says something like, there he goes again, Your Honor, or something like that, or something to that effect? Is that where the city manager basically prompted the mayor to take action? Is that what you're referring to?
And just the fact that the city manager is not supposed to be speaking during public comments. It's the citizen's time to speak. And he was censoring his speech by speaking over him, by forcing the city mayor and the police chief to arrest him. Keep in mind also, the city manager is responsible for, at least in Texas, the city manager is the boss, not the mayor, but is the boss of the police chief. The city managers really run the cities in Texas. We have a weak mayor system of government here.
Right, right.
And so the fact that the city manager has never bothered to hold the chief of police accountable for his Fourth Amendment violations, for his First Amendment violations, is why he's named in there, because he's the one that's creating these policies and encouraging these policies to have his police chief arrest people based on First Amendment speech.
And why weren't other members of the governing body listed in the lawsuit? Like, why wasn't every member of the governing body cited as a defendant?
Because the only people that were actively engaged in violating my client's rights were the Carrie Scruggs, one of the city councilwoman, because she's the one that sent these cease and desist letters. She's the one that defamed my client on social media. And then the mayor, of course, because he's the one that was ordering the police chief to have us removed from the meeting based on our free speech. He was also the one that was interrupting our 3 minutes of speech based on content, because he didn't like the content of the speech. He didn't like the way we were speaking. And unfortunately, whether you like it or not, and again, I say people try be civil, because if you really want your message to get across, the best way you're going to win people's support is by doing it civilly. But even if they're not civil, they have a right to, unfortunately, be uncivil. That's just sort of, it's been that way since America was formed. I mean, do you think it was very civil throwing tea into Boston Harbor? No.
Well, we did have a raucous beginning. You're right. One more thing on the defendant's side. So with respect to the police officers who actually came up to the podium to both you and Falwell and escorted you out, why are they not named? Or is there a reason behind that, out of curiosity?
We could have named them, but to be honest, this was just a matter of they're kind of doing what they're told.
Right.
They're kind of the foot soldiers. They don't have the kind of information and knowledge and training that the police chief has. And
do they theoretically have liability in that situation then or no? They do?
Yes, we could have sued them because the case law is out there. And if there's already been case law on issues like speech, I mean, look at Terry v. Ohio. You know, they can't just walk up. Cops are supposed to know you can't just walk up and start searching people without reasonable suspicion. Similarly, they're supposed to know that cases like Cohen v. California is out there, that you're allowed to have a sign that says F the draft and you can't be arrested for it. So theoretically, we could have arrested those guys. But really, they're kind of pawns of the police chief and the city mayor and the city manager. And we didn't want to kind of ruin them and throw them through the ringer. We wanted to just go after the people we thought were actively engaged in the violation of rights, not being used as the scapegoats.
So what happens now? You file this $5 million lawsuit, right? I mean, is that like a pie in the sky number? Is that like a, yeah, okay, good luck getting that? I mean, where is this going to go realistically in your opinion? Obviously, I was looking at your video clips and you were touting the fact that I think you've won every case that you've, is it fair to say you've won every case that you've done except maybe one? I saw one video recently about a case where you said that you lost it, I guess, in the last couple months or something like that. But what's the realistic outcome of this situation with Aransas Pass? What kind of liability or exposure do they really have here as a city?
I think the likelihood in this case is actually higher that they're going to lose a lot of money than in many other cases that I'm actively engaged in around the state of Texas. This isn't the only First Amendment lawsuit that I filed, but it is the first $5 million lawsuit that I filed because this is done knowingly. This isn't just about them telling people, we're going to arrest you if you don't leave a city council meeting. This is about them filing bogus charges, retaliation, having an attorney literally quote them the law and still continue with the kinds of behavior that the law has said they can't engage in. And so the $5 million is meant to teach them a lesson that you're not above the law. Just because you're an elected official, just because you wear a badge, just because you have a title, don't think that you can just bully people in the state of Texas or in the United States of America where they have rights. And this was done knowingly, it was done intentionally, and it was done in a retaliatory fashion. It wasn't just passively done. They knew what they were doing. I had had conversations with the chief personally. I've been in his office speaking to him, trying to get him educated on the law to prevent a $5 million lawsuit. And all they've done is doubled down since last year.
So it kind of goes back to what I said earlier in the podcast about how you kind of set this transparent sort of trap for them. And because they've kind of walked into it, you think they're at really serious risk at this point?
I really do. And again, my goal is not to go around arresting every city I can find that violates people's rights. I tell people all the time, I want to sue my city. I'm like, well, I'll tell you what, why don't we just do a demand letter first? Why don't we just see if we can change their behavior by sending a letter from your attorney saying, look, this is how I believe you've violated my client's rights. This is how my client would like you to fix it. Can you fix it? And then if they just say no, then we escalate from there and eventually get to the lawsuit phase. I don't jump straight into lawsuits.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Now, when it comes to this lawsuit, are any of these individuals personally liable or is this all being going to be paid for by taxpayers and insurance? Can you walk us through that? Because let's just say there's some city managers that are listening to this podcast and they might be sympathetic to your side or they might be opposing you. I don't, there could be people on all different sides of the issue here, but everyone's going to have some concern or thought about, hey, what is my personal exposure or liability in a sense like this? So can you walk us through, and maybe you can speak only to Texas, I guess, but what is the city manager and the mayors and the police chief, what is their personal liability in a situation like this, if any?
So the good news is that for most people, the personal liability is very low. Most city managers, if they're acting in their official capacity, don't have to worry about losing their house or anything like that. I don't sue people in their personal capacities because generally when they violate my client's rights, they're not acting in their personal capacity. They're acting in their official capacity under the color of law. And so as such, you go after the entity that employs them and you go after them in their official capacities. You can go after their bonds. That's another avenue that I'm starting to look into about getting sort of short-term fixes or remedies is by going after their bonds. And if they can't be bonded, they can't serve. Because if you start going after these people's bonds and the bonds have to keep getting paid out to victims, eventually they're not going to be able to get bonded. But personally, you know, I guess it's good news. Most city managers and city councils, as long as they're acting in their official roles, don't generally have to worry about being personally held liable. And I think a lot of the mistakes that are made in people that don't have attorneys is going after people in their personal capacities because they're given qualified immunity. Hey, look, I'm just doing my job. And if you think I'm doing my job wrong, that's a whole nother issue. But when I said, get out of my city council meeting, I didn't do that as Ram Gomez. I did that as Mayor Gomez.
Right. Okay. So walk us through now then, what's the timeline, how this is going to play out? I mean, I don't know, a case like this, is this going to be like a 3-year affair? Like what do you see naturally the course of the ebb and flow of a case like this?
So generally cases like this, they can take, it's really up to the city at this point because
That's a good point. Okay, so walk me through that, CJ. You file this lawsuit, right? And essentially, what can the city right now do to avoid going to court? I guess enter some sort of settlement discussion with you guys, or
what? Yeah, they can mediate it. We can sit down and have a discussion, attorney to attorney, client to client, and try to hammer this out and find some middle ground. They can just deny everything and say we're going to go to court, and that's going to be a 2 to 4 year process, probably. And I'm not one of those guys that keeps pushing things down. I want resolution. My clients don't want to wait. I filed a lawsuit in 2020 against the city of Olmos Park, and we just got done with the Fifth Circuit here last week. So these things take a long time, and I want to get them done as quickly as possible and get resolution and move on is what I would prefer to do, but it's completely up to them.
I'm going to ask you a question to put you on the spot, CJ. So yeah. Is there anything right now the city of Aransas Pass could do to stop this and not have to pay out a settlement of any kind to you guys and somehow say, you know, make a mea culpa of some kind and make amends? Is there anything that can be done at this point, or does there have to be some sort of financial repercussion no matter what, regardless of what the amount is?
So there's going to be some financial because my clients out thousands of dollars because of their acts. So, you know, if they would just pay my clients' expenses up to this point and quit, move away from government, and recognize that you are terrible leaders and terrible administrators of government and just step down, we will drop our $5 million lawsuit. Pay my clients' bills and step down.
You talk about literally the elected official as well as the police chief as well as the city manager, all that's the only way that would basically, you're saying they have to step down?
That's it. That's it. That's the only way without money that my client's going to accept anything else, because I don't think they understand or even accept responsibility for what they've done. They think they're right. And as long as they think they're right, it's either going to cost them money or it's going to cost them their jobs. And unfortunately, and this is the unfortunate aspect of it, you know, I can't charge them with abuse of authority under color of law. And the government's not going to charge them because government protects itself. And, you know, the chief works for the city manager. So, of course, he's not going to arrest the city manager and he's not going to arrest the mayor for him doing the arresting. That's sort of the unfortunate side effect of our system, is that the only recourse that people have is the dollar. And hopefully it's a big enough dollar amount that people in the community start paying attention and go, wait a minute, these guys just cost the city $5 million or $1 million or $10,000 or whatever it is, because they refuse to just do the right thing.
Right. And yeah. When I was an activist, CJ, I called it the transference of pain model. I mean, if you don't make it painful for them to stop doing what they're doing, they're not going to stop doing what they're doing. Right. So it has to hurt in some form or fashion. It could be financial. It could be political. It could be, you know, reputation, all kinds of stuff, but it has to hurt. Otherwise they're not going to change their behavior. And so I understand where you're coming from. And I kind of teed that up a little bit to put you on the spot because I wanted to open this up now. I'm sure the police chief's lawsuit or a criminal charge or whatever against you doesn't really want to make you want to soften your stance a little bit after you file the $5 million lawsuit. Walk us through what exactly is this charge or whatever being levied against you? Can you unpack that for us? Because this just happened, right?
Yeah. In Texas, it's a penal code 38.13. It's hindering proceedings by disorderly conduct. And it's a very generic. I've already filed a motion to dismiss on my behalf. I'm almost done with my client's motion to dismiss because this is all protected speech. So I think I'm very, very confident that we're going to have it dismissed based on First Amendment issues and the fact that it's retaliatory. And that's really, you know, the fact that they did that is where I don't think my client at this point, because he was also charged. My client also got charged under 3813. And so I think at this point, the only thing that we're willing to accept, because they obviously don't even want to talk. They want to use the power of government to, like you said, make it hurt. So the only thing we can do in response is make it hurt, because I can't go and throw them in handcuffs. I can't go and force charges against them. The only thing I can do is force them to fight me in court. And that's what we're going to do.
Got you. Since this all happened, you obviously, your profile has been growing, I'm sure, over the last couple of years as you entered the space, because you're kind of doing something that's kind of niche that not a lot of people are really working on, in my understanding. Since Arantzas Pass or whatnot, what's kind of been the response or feedback you've been getting either from Arantzas Pass or other places? I'm just kind of curious what the fallout has been, if anything.
What I have learned, and I'm kind of glad that you have a national city manager sort of ear or voice, because I'm getting emails and phone calls from Missouri, Florida, Washington State, Maine, Kentucky, Tennessee, California, Colorado, Montana. I'm trying to think of whether Virginia. I mean, this exact same issue is across this entire country, and everyone is saying, please tell me you know an attorney like you in my state. Can you recommend an attorney like you in my state? And that's kind of been an eye-opener to me, because it's telling me this isn't just a problem in the small town of Arantzas Pass, Texas. This is a problem that is national, and I don't know what's driving it, but what I think is happening is that government is forgetting its purpose. Government is forgetting that its sole purpose is not to lord over us. And this is where we get down this long road where we're literally just ruling people's lives, every aspect of their lives and what they do. We're controlling every aspect of it, how you can speak, how you can have your own yard, what you can put in your yard, what kind of color paint you can have on your own house, your own property. We're regulating every aspect of people's lives, and they're starting to get fed up with it. And then they wonder why everybody's so angry and why everybody is so uncivil when you're criminalizing everything and you're stealing their money and you're stealing their freedom and you're threatening them with all of these things, like taking their property, taking their vehicles because, you know, they're 0.01% over the emissions standards or whatever it is. And I think people are just getting fed up. You know, we started a revolution over a 3% tax. Look where we are now. I just think government has forgotten that its purpose is to protect the rights and liberties of people and to protect people's rights, not to lord over them and control every aspect of their lives. And until government realizes that, they're never going to understand why we are so upset. They're never going to understand why they created this monster called CJ Grisham, who was so happy to just go live on his farm after he retired from the military after two combat tours. All I wanted to do was work on my farm. And the police created this monster. And then the judicial system created this monster. And then the political system created this monster. And it's creating monsters everywhere. People are waking up and they're getting frustrated and fed up. And we need people in government that are just and in the system that have been treated like people like me, like my clients, and recognize that something's got to change. It's not that we need to be more civil. It's that government needs to be more civil towards us.
So what would be your recommendation for the city managers? I don't know, be interested. I'm really curious to see what kind of feedback I get from this episode, because it's a very unique one in this catalog that I've started in this podcast. But what would be your recommendation for the city managers? And I actually have an increasing number of elected officials who are actually following my content on LinkedIn and the podcast. What would be your recommendation to the city managers and elected officials who are listening to this as far as when it comes to handling public comment periods?
You know, if you're going to do public comment periods, and I highly recommend them, because when you only allow people to speak on the agenda items, that means you're only allowing people to speak about things that are important to government, not the things that are important to people. And you have to understand that if you're doing everything right, you know, if you're trying to take care of your people to the best of your abilities, you're not going to have people like me and my client that are super upset. You're never going to be able to please everybody. But, you know, I'll say my city of Temple does it right. They have these public comments and they allow people to speak. And then, you know, we go out there and we vent, we talk about what frustrates us. And then we will get an email from an appropriate person. The city manager will direct a particular department that is responsible for my complaint. hey, will you respond to this or give me the information so I can respond to this? And then the city councils and the county commissioners or whatever they're called, just, you know, recognize that people are important more than just during the election time when you need their vote. And you need to continue to that outreach, that same outreach where you're knocking on doors when you're running for office should be the same when you're in office. If somebody's got a complaint, address it. And if the individual is wrong, kind of try to explain to them why, hey, look here, I understand you're upset. I get it, but here's why this happened. Here's the rule. Here's why my hands are tied. Here's why I can't do anything. And then, you know, when I was in the military, I never said no to a soldier or to a leader. If I was asked to do something, I always said no, but no, I can't do that. But here's what I can do, or here's what I will do, or here's how we can try and change it. When you just tell people, sorry, that's just the way it is, you're not fixing any problems. If you're telling people, look, this is just the way
you're actually compounding that perception or belief that government is that doesn't listen, doesn't do anything, right?
And it's exactly, you
know, yeah.
And government has to start being more personable and recognize that just because you sit on a higher platform when you're behind that dais doesn't mean that you're on a higher level of importance than the people that are out there in front of you in the audience.
So, you know, some of my peers, you know, it's fascinating because I've said this before. I used to be an activist and I used to be, it's a very surreal deal to be having this podcast interview and with you and talking to other city managers, because I've literally been in protests and city council meetings where we've shut down council meetings as an activist. And, you know, I don't really get into those conversations a little bit on this platform because it's a past chapter. So I have a very comprehensive 360 degree perspective when it comes to this issue. And it fascinates me greatly because on one hand, I've always been, you know, the people have a right to petition their government and so forth and so on. And, you know, the people are, I'm very much a Jeffersonian, right? This idea that the power comes from the people form their government as they choose, as they see fit. They can change their government as they see fit because the people are in control. At least that's, you know, what I believe as a Jeffersonian. And then I get into this position as a city manager, city administrator. And I got to tell you, CJ, it's frustrating because, you know, we're working for the city, we're working for the taxpayers, and honestly, we just want to get shit done, right? Like, you know, it's like, you know, and so there's a lot of folks in my position who say, you know what, these are business meetings of the city. These are not meant to be areas for the citizens to sort of petition and air their grievances on everything that they have, that, you know, hey, we got to get through the city's business, right? These are business meetings. And so there's a little bit of pushback in that regard. Do you see that where that perspective is coming from, or do you just completely disagree with it? Or do you think that, hey, I understand that perspective, but we gotta tolerate it? What's your thought process on that from the city managers? Can you see the city manager perspective?
Oh, absolutely. And I could,
these meetings are long. I mean, here's the thing. I've seen I'm not going to name the county, right? Cause they've been going through some tense stuff, right? I've seen some county meetings that were literally going 10, 11, 12, 13 hours because the public comment periods are so caustic and so combative. I mean, literally every item is being contested by, you know, double digit people who want to speak for the 3 minutes and go in and rail against the governing body. You know what I mean? And so you have staff sitting there for literally 10 hours. The whole day is nothing but a damn county government meeting.
Yeah. And I think I understand that that's when they do their meetings and that's when they take care of a lot of the public type of business. And what they should be doing then in that case is for when it comes to citizen comments, at least in Texas, you know, they have to speak on the agenda items. They have to let people speak on that. And I think every government body should allow a citizen's comments on off-agenda stuff. But if you're worried about it interfering with the government business, then put it at the end of your meetings so that you get all your government business done with. And, you know, hey, look, if the government is engaging in stuff that is very controversial, they need to expect the fact that they're going to get all of these opinions on controversial issues. So the best thing is to do, stay away from controversial issues then if you're a government person, but recognize that these open meetings are, they're not just about business meetings. This is when the people get to see exactly what their elected officials are doing and take part in that government. Remember, this isn't people ruling over us. These are people who are representing us, who are doing our business as part of a government. They're taking care of what we need as a body, as elected officials. That's what the whole republic is made of, is people doing full-time what we, the people, can't do. are doing part-time what we the people can't do full-time. And so when we get out of this idea that this is a business meeting and get into the idea that this is the people's meeting, and we're just telling them what we as their representatives are doing, and we're showing them what we're doing, that's when we start meeting a little bit more in the middle. And this idea of us versus them gets narrowed, because what they're doing is in the collective body's best interest. And you're always going to have the extremities. It doesn't matter how good you are of a city council. Doesn't matter how noble you are as a city council. Doesn't matter how just you are as a city council. There are always going to be people who just don't like government, period.
Sure.
And what they need to do is just suck it up for 3 minutes, let people get it off their chests. And then when they've calmed down, send out that email, send out that phone call, reach out, you know, knock on that door. I understand you were upset. Let's talk about it. And that's when we're going to start getting back to the civility aspect of it, but not threatening criminal charges against people because you disagree with the way that they treat you during a meeting.
So, you know, something that's always kind of annoyed me as an activist, this is where, oh man, these conversations are so fascinating to me and surreal. You know, in California, when I used to be an activist or whatnot, you know, you'd go to these council meetings and they'd want you to state your name and your address and so forth and so on. Are those legally required by law? Are you required to force somebody to give you that information? Because I would tell them to basically pound sand. I'm not going to give you my information on that. And we see that all across the country. And I'm kind of curious, is that a legitimate ask or request in order to demand a resident provide that information? And before you answer that, the second thing is, because we're seeing a lot of the Zoom bombing and things with these combative situations arising, I've even seen some local governments talk about limiting public comment to just residents and no one else besides residents. Can you expand on what your thoughts on those two aspects are?
Yeah, that's actually a big thing that I've been fighting against as well, is this idea that if you're not a resident, you can't speak during citizen comments. Here's the fallacy in that argument, is that everyone has a right. The public is the people. And just because I don't live within a geographic boundary doesn't mean that I can't petition the leaders for redress. When I walk into or drive into that boundary, I am subject to the rules, the ordinances, the laws of that city. And if I have my rights abused by the police in that city, I have a right to seek that redress if I'm not a citizen. So there is a constitutional argument against this idea that you have to live within the city to go to the city council meeting, or you have to live within the county to go to the county meeting. And we had a case here recently where a man was killed by an unarmed man was killed by police officers, and the family lives outside of the city. Are you saying that they can't come into the city to complain about how the police are handling minority unarmed men? Yeah, you know, they have every right to seek redress as anybody else does. And I'll say this too. I do not support at all, in any way, shape, or form, shutting down city council meetings. What I am limiting my protest to and my defense of my clients to is that when they are given 3 minutes to speak, that is their time, not the government's time. That is 3 minutes out of hours of whatever it is that they've been doing up to that point, that they get to remark on anything they want to remark on. That's my time. And I don't think they have, you know, if I had been shouting all those things that I had said, and it wasn't my turn to speak, for example, someone else was speaking or they were talking on another agenda item, I would agree that I'm out of line. And I think people are out of line when you're shutting down meetings, because you're not just shutting down that meeting, but now you're shutting down
another person.
My government is doing for me. Right. They can't work on my behalf because you're shutting them down. So that's what I'm strictly limiting that to. And what was your other question? I think I missed the first
about one. Residency, not residency requirement, but the other question was about whether or not you can require individuals to divulge their address.
Oh yeah. So no, you know, when you go back, there is a right, and it's been enshrined in case law, and it's also in our constitution. There is a right under the 9th Amendment, I would argue, to anonymity. And there's case law out there about the right to anonymity. And I've successfully fought this, thankfully only with demand letters, where the city managers were refusing to allow people to speak during public comments because they didn't divulge their address. And what I think people need to understand, especially in this cancel culture age, is that's very dangerous. When someone is required to divulge their address and they say something that someone else may not like, you're now putting that person, that citizen, in danger.
At risk.
At risk of being attacked, of being stalked, of having their property destroyed, because you've just told the world where they live. And we as the people have a right to anonymity. You look back at the Federalist Papers and the non-Federalist paper or anti-Federalist Papers, and they went under pseudonyms and fake names, you know, commenting under Publius when they were talking about their opposition to the Constitution or their support of the Constitution, because they didn't want to be personally attacked based on their opinions. So yeah, this goes way back to the founding.
Yeah, the reason why I bring that up, CJ, is because I've seen a lot of chatter about requiring individuals to register or sign in response to a lot of the Zoom bombing and some of the racial epithets that are getting hurled or anti-Semitic comments that are being made too. That's creeped up, obviously, with the Israel-Palestine situation as well. Right. So your position is that it would be illegal for a city council to require individuals to sign their name and or address when it comes to a public comment period, meaning that I could just show up to a public comment and just save my 3 minutes if I want to, right? Is that what your position is?
Right. And obviously if the city council needs to know who they're calling, I mean, you can put something down there, you know, Joe Smith or whatever, but this is also discriminatory against homeless people. What are they supposed to put down? You know, what if you don't have a home? Are you not allowed to speak just because you're homeless? And so it becomes discriminatory to require people to divulge an address, because now you're discriminating against people who do not have an address.
We're getting a little long in the tooth here on this podcast, but I have a few more things I wanted to pound out, if you don't mind, CJ. So another thing I've seen is cities that are going out and basically editing the video after the fact, either edit out some of the profanities or maybe some of the racist statements or things like that. We're seeing that with some of the Zoom bombing and things of that sort of nature. Do you have any thoughts on whether a city can and can't do that when it comes to editing the meeting after the fact and publishing it?
I do, because once again, you are censoring based on the content of speech. And you are now, not only are you censoring a person's right to speak, but you're censoring a person's right to receive information that is couched in the form of speech. There's nothing wrong with putting something under it saying, you know, warning foul language or whatever, you know, go forward at your own leisure or whatever, or even identifying certain segments during the city council. You know, if you don't want to hear these kinds of words, skip minute 1 through 3 or whatever. That's the way you deal with that. Give people their own option on whether or not they want to be subjected to government censorship.
So even muting it or bleeping a curse word, again, you're saying it would be a violation, and you would make a case that that's something you can't do, correct?
I think a case could be made. It's a de minimis violation. Like if you're just doing beep, beep, you know, yeah. I mean, I think people understand what's probably underneath that beep, and it doesn't take away from the message. But when you completely silence the entire person because during that speech there's words, that's where it gets bad. But I wouldn't see any problem necessarily with beeping out words that, you know, perhaps people don't want to hear.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, two more things. Are you familiar with a gentleman by the name of James Freed and the Supreme Court case that revolving a city manager and his Facebook page and editing out or blocking somebody from commenting on his page, a private citizen? Have you familiar with this at all? James Freed is someone I've had on my podcast before. It's a Supreme Court decision. Obviously, it's a very big, influential case. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the idea, because, you know, I, as a city manager, city administrator, public sector official, I make the case that my private Facebook page is my private Facebook page, and I can say whatever I want, essentially, in that regard, and I can block people from reading it and viewing it. It's also one of the reasons why I very, very, very rarely ever talk about anything related to my occupation with respect to my current LinkedIn platform, just to be on the safe side. But what are your thoughts on that Supreme Court decision right now and where that's going with respect to, I'm talking about city managers, not government officials or elected officials right now, but I'm talking about just city managers and other public sector employees as far as their Facebook social media presence.
If you are a public sector employee and you want to discuss matters related to your job that have to do with sharing of public information or putting out, whether you're a mayor, a city manager, a city administrator, I highly recommend that you either use the city's official page or you create your own separate, like, official city manager type page. Once you use your personal page to put out official information, you have now converted your personal page into an official page. Now, I don't believe that, for example, you know, Joseph Turner, city manager, is a city manager, but he's got his own, you know, family Facebook page. I don't think that I have a right to your personal family Facebook page, as long as you're not using that page to put out official information as the city manager. That's where you get into the problems. And so,
there's a difference between putting out official information and also, I guess, the Supreme Court decision right now, which is, you know, it's still kind of in flux. It got remanded back. I'm not a legal expert or scholar how this whole thing works, but they're basically saying, as I understand it, is that as long as you are releasing information that is already out there on other government channels and so forth and so on, that you're not essentially converting your personal page into a public page. But if you are releasing information, say you're breaking news about the city or whatnot on your personal page, then that's when you're really kind of walking into a danger zone, because you are using that private page in a public capacity, so to speak.
So, exactly. And so, like, sharing City of Aransas past post about, you know, upcoming emergency operations, and you share it on your private page just to let your friends and family know what's going on, that does not convert your private page into an official page.
And you support that idea, right?
And I support that idea. Absolutely. Okay. I still think government officials deserve their own privacy as well. They deserve to go home and be able to let go and leave behind the political aspect of what they do every day. It shouldn't follow them home unless they bring it home with them. And I don't think in these cases that's what they're doing. I definitely support that idea that you should be able to have a private life and a public life. And as long as you don't mingle the two, you're not coming up against any constitutional walls or anything.
Okay, awesome. So as we wrap up here, CJ, I was kind of curious, like, you know, you haven't been practicing law for a long time. Obviously, I'm going to say you're a middle-aged convert to the legal profession.
Yes.
Yep. What has been the response from your peers in the Texas legal community when it comes to, and I'll say this in a not antagonistic way, but your shenanigans? What kind of response do you get from the Texas legal community, the Bar Association? I don't know how that legal community works in regards if you're a lone wolf over here and you don't really have much interaction, but I'm just kind of curious, what's been your experience on that front?
You know, it is a very lonely life being an activist attorney. There are very few of us, and the few of us that there are, we get along great. There are also those people that sort of support you, but they don't want to be vocal about it because
I know the feeling.
They want to play the game. But you know, I actually had a judge, and I won't even say where this was because I don't want to out this person. I'm not even going to say if it's a male or female. But I had a judge actually tell me that the judge was happy that I decided to go to law school because the system needs attorneys who are willing to question judges and question prosecutors, because especially defense attorneys, because they're getting away with way too much. There's no one willing to stand up to them, and they know that I'm willing to stand up to them. And, you know, my thoughts are, if you're not doing anything wrong, I'm not a problem for you at all. If you're a good cop, I'm your best friend. I actually represent several cops on matters, generally whistleblowing matters. But I have a couple of cops that are clients of mine because they also know that I'm not necessarily anti-cop. I don't like law enforcement anymore, and I come from law enforcement, but I do like individual officers. There are good cops out there. There are good city managers out there. I love my city council. There are some things that they do wrong, and I have a great relationship where I can approach them personally, or I can send them an email, and they know that even if I'm boisterous in my email, and they know that it's coming from the heart. I'm not just being so. It in the legal field, you know, there's this idea that you have to act a certain way. I did not become
an
attorney.
A certain decorum, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? Look, in court, you will not find a person more professional than me in the court. Well, you probably will, but I'm very professional in the courtroom. I understand that a court is not a city council meeting. I understand that there are rules that have to be followed, that I have to abide by those rules. But I also understand that when I became an attorney, I did not surrender my rights. I did not surrender my freedom, and I did not surrender my principles, values, or beliefs. I've just got to be able to represent my clients in the best way I possibly can. As long as I'm doing that, I expect the bar to leave me alone. I expect the system to leave me alone, allow me to keep doing what I'm doing until and unless I violate those rules of ethics.
So in the, funny you say that, so violate the rule of ethics. So in the city management profession, there's a professional organization called the ICMA. I'm not a member of the ICMA, but there's a group called the ICMA that has its own code of ethics that city managers are supposed to follow. And if you do not follow those code of that code of ethics, you theoretically could have somebody report you to the organization and you can face sanctions, whether it's a public censure, private censure, expulsion, et cetera. Has anyone filed any complaints or I guess any complaints against you? And I don't know how that works. Have you been subjected to anything like that? I'm just curious.
I did get one complaint back in November from an Antifa kid in Florida that didn't like the fact that I called gun grabbers or gun control activists essentially the same thing as pedophiles. And so he reported me to the bar. And yeah, so I mean, that got dismissed pretty quickly because I'm allowed to have opinions and the bar didn't, you know, they obviously sent me the complaint, but showed that it had just been dismissed as an inquiry, not a complaint, because I didn't do anything wrong. I'm allowed to have an opinion. That's the only thing I've had so far. And I did have one client who was not very happy because, you know, I ended up, and this goes back to the, you know, he was blocked on Facebook by a government entity and I was able to get him a couple $1,000s for that. And just for being blocked on Facebook, but he was complaining that it wasn't enough and that I was weak. And I'm like, dude, you just got a couple $1,000s for being blocked on Facebook and you're going to complain about me? I charged you nothing for that.
Well, how do you make a living then? I got a percentage of it. But you ain't making a lot of money on a couple grand settlement or whatever.
No, not at all.
So, but how do you, I mean, maybe a little too personal. I don't know. How do you make a living right now as an activist attorney? How does that work?
Well, believe it or not, I mean, I do a whole lot of stuff. I do gun trusts as well. And I still do criminal cases that have a civil rights angle to them. Cause sometimes you've got to get through the criminal aspect so that you can get to the civil aspect. But I'm also a combat disabled retired soldier and I have a regular income. I don't need legal income to make a living and to make ends meet. So I'm in a different position. I don't have any law school debt. I don't have any college debt. So
is that because the GI Bill paid for your law school?
And there's something called vocational rehabilitation and education. So for guys like me that are disabled, that can't work in the jobs that we used to work in, they'll retrain you. They'll pay to retrain you. And I can't have a job that's like a 9 to 5 Monday through Friday because of my back injury and because of my migraines and vertigo that I get from my brain injury. So I have to be able to set my own schedule. And that's why I was able to get that training.
Let me end with this, CJ. Are you a happy person? Do you feel fulfilled? Because, you know, when I saw the video, you kind of come off a little bit as like an angry douche. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I mean, are you
happy? I mean, do you feel good?
I am incredibly happy. I have a beautiful wife. I have three wonderful kids. My youngest daughter is about to graduate college as a nurse. My two oldest kids have graduated college and are very successful in what they do. I have two grandchildren that I spend so much time with, and I've got another third grandchild coming here in about a month or two. I love standing up for the Constitution. What makes me angry is people violating that, but it makes me happy that I can defend them against it. So I am incredibly happy. I love life. I love people. I love helping people. That's what this job does for me. I'm incredibly happy. I am not happy when people abuse the rights of others and then abuse the system to help further that.
Good deal. Good deal.
I get to meet people like you.
Yeah.
How can I be angry when I get to talk to guys like you?
Over your lips to God's ears, huh? We'll wrap up with this, CJ. Why don't you let people know how they can find you, get in touch with you, and just give you opportunity to plug your situation here.
Yeah. So my website is cjgrisham.com. And I'm on YouTube and Facebook. Just type in CJ Grisham, you'll find me. I don't hide behind fake names and all that kind of stuff. I'm on Twitter as CJ Grisham, although I don't really go there because Twitter does make me angry. And so I try to stay away from situations that make me angry. And it's just, there's nothing good on Twitter. I do get a lot of news from there, but I try not to engage too much because anyway, I get angry there. But cjgrisham.com, and I'm also the founder of Open Carry Texas. And I do a lot of work at the legislature and I really just try to keep to myself, but that's how you can find me if you're in Texas. And, you know, if you are a city manager, I work with prosecutors too. I have prosecutors that call me and they're like, hey, I've got this case. Is this really a self-defense case? And even though I'm a defense attorney, and I'll tell them, well, I wouldn't be able to argue self-defense in that case. And so they trust me enough at this point, even after only, you know, a year and a half of doing this, because I've been so successful in these cases, they come to me and ask, you know, am I in trouble for doing this? I've had a mayor come to me and say, hey, CJ, you know, are these signs, can I put up these signs or those signs? I am an open book, and I will tell you exactly how I feel and give you the upfront opinion, even if I disagree with it. So if you're a city manager out there and you're wondering, am I violating someone's rights if I do this? Send me an email, cj@cjgrisham.com. And, you know, just ask the question. I'll respond and let you know, what I would do as an attorney, whether I think that's a violation or not.
Excellent. Hey, CJ, thank you very much for being on the show. I really enjoyed the conversation. It's a fascinating topic right now in the state of local government when it comes to public comments and how we should be handling them. It's just becoming a growing issue. And so I've really enjoyed having you on the show to talk about these issues, for you to give us your perspective. And I hope some of the city managers listening have enjoyed it as well. So thank you very much. I am Joe Turner. This is the City Manager Unfiltered Podcast, a podcast for city managers and other public sector executives. If you really enjoyed the show, please hit that rate and subscribe button on Apple, Spotify, your platform of choice, and catch you next time. Thank you very much.